Hello and welcome to another episode of How Not to Make a Game. I'm your host Stuart Neil, and joining me tonight is Alan Thorne, who was appointed the Head of Games Design and Development MA at NFTS, which is the National Film and Television School. Hi, Alan.
Good evening, good evening. Really happy to be here. Thank you for having me here, Stuart.
Oh, thank you for coming on. The invitation kind of came out of the blue, so it did, but I'm really happy to have you on board, especially just with my interest in the games that have been designed by the NFTS students and what have you over the years.
Yeah, absolutely. Some really great games coming out of the course, so really, really excited to talk about them.
About yourself then, how did you get into the games development industry?
Well, I guess to start, I mean, I've been a game developer now for the past 20 years. I think I started in about 1999 was when I started way back in the games industry. And, you know, back at that time, there were no games courses around. And I started, you know, because I just really was kind of lost in life, and I really loved playing video games. Mm-hmm. And there was something about just the getting lost in virtual worlds that just really, really excited me. And so one day I decided to teach myself computer programming. That was a real challenge. It took me a long time to learn that. It was really, really crazy getting my head around that. Mm-hmm. But then I started out making some games, working in the United States, actually, working on some RPG games that are buried in the mists of time now, but I love them dearly. And then from there, really, I went from studio to studio working on different games projects. Eventually I went freelance. I really loved that, and then decided to establish, you know, my own game studio and to create games that were just dear to my heart. And when I established my own game studio in about 2009, I decided to create a point-and-click adventure game. I absolutely love those. And I'm thinking of things like, you know, Day of the Tentacle, Mist, Riven. You just explore a mysterious world and solve mysteries. And really, that was what motivated me to go into games. Mm. And then I ended up running a games course, which is great. And as you mentioned, you know, we've got some great students turning out some really interesting projects. So always happy to help other people make games too. Really love it.
Mm-hmm. What was your first role within the industry then?
I started out as a computer programmer. Very first day, I always remember it. You know, very first day, I sat down at my desk. They presented me with some really, really difficult maths problems. And the very first thing that came into my mind was, I really wish I'd paid more attention at school because these problems are really, really hard. Mm-hmm. So it was at that moment when I really appreciated just how much time at school I wasted and how I had so much catching up to do. But I'm eternally grateful to the games industry for really just helping me become a better student in life generally, because I knew on that day that if I was going to keep my job and I was going to stay in the games industry, I had to learn pretty quick. Mm-hmm. So I started as an engine programmer and involved lots of maths, lots of physics, lots of calculations and all that kind of stuff. So I just got the first books I could find on the subject, learnt about it, and it really started from there, computer programming in C++.
What other roles did you have in the industry?
So I've worked in various capacities, mainly as a programmer. I've also worked as a 3D artist, making weapons and other kinds of environments. Environmental art was my main focus whenever I worked as an artist. And then running my own game studio, you know, that involved games design, that involved games business, that involved just the whole caboodle of being an indie developer, living an indie life, and just putting together games and having to do it all yourself. So working in a tiny indie game studio was really what really taught me so many skills and realized just how holistic games development is. It's one of the things that I absolutely love about making games is that you never stop learning, and the boundaries of where does a programmer end and an artist begin, they can easily get so blurred, and you just never know what's in store when you take that decision to make games for yourself.
Mm-hmm. What about them moving from being a games developer into becoming an educator? How did that happen?
Well, yeah, I think really that happened because I started writing books. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons that I started writing books, and I'm on book 36 now, but I started writing books mainly to teach myself. I found that I learned things much better when I started writing them down, I started clarifying my thoughts. The process of writing was also a process of learning. And I think that the process of learning and trying to teach others and finding that bug of, oh, I'm helping other people make games and I'm finding this really, really satisfying. And actually, I'm having people who months or years later are sending me emails saying, you know, oh, Alan, that book, I picked up that book. I learned how to make games from it. And you know what? I'm now working at EA, or I'm now working at Blizzard, or I'm working here, or I'm working there. And it was really satisfying to be able to write these books, help other people. And I thought, wow, this is really, really great. So the transition was more, in my view, something that happened in parallel, because I'm still helping students make games. I'm still helping people make games. So I'm still actively involved in the development of games. But at the same time, I'm helping people learn how to do it as well. So I see it as a two-way thing. I'm helping people learn. They're helping me learn new things as well. And I think that at some point in about 2015 was when I really started to be more serious about being an educator. I started working for a while at Teesside University. I started creating online video content for LinkedIn Learning. And now I'm running the MA Games Design and Development course at the National Film and Television School. It's a two-year MA course.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned there just about the video content and things. How different is it creating video tutorials compared to writing a book?
Oh, I think, and this is a really interesting question because, you know, I think that writing the books, I think that's really great for approaching programming content, for trying to learn and teach materials that are incredibly technical, involve a lot of precision. I find that the book is a really great medium for that. You can always go back to the book and you can study the words and you can digest them more seriously. So I think that for technical subjects, I find a book is a little bit drier, I think, but it presents technical material very well. If you're focusing on artistic content, creating 3D worlds, getting people excited just about the act of making games and putting your personality into it and having a bit of a joke and having a bit of a humor, I think it's more like having a conversation with a user. So I love both, but I think that they're slightly better at different things. I think that books are better for teaching technical content like coding, and video content is better for helping people get into games and for building 3D art and animation.
Okay. With you doing both the books and the video tutorial, and obviously now working in formal education with both NFTS and Teesside, are self-taught developers any less valid than formally educated ones?
No, I don't think so. I think that it doesn't matter whether you're formally educated or not, you can still turn around amazing games. Mm-hmm. You've only got to see the long list of AAA indie titles and the variety of people who have worked on them. Some have come from formal education, some not. And in every single case, they've built a success of their lives and it's a success of their careers. The quality and the value of developers is not related to that. Obviously, there are different pathways to becoming a games developer. Mm-hmm. And it's not that one is right and one is wrong. They're just two completely different ways to reach the same destination.
Do you think the industry puts too much emphasis on formal educations, especially with regards to the job application processes?
Well, I think that that's not so much an industry thing as a studio culture thing.
Okay.
There will be some studios who will place too much emphasis in either direction.
Mm.
You can have a studio that places too much emphasis on the certificate and the qualifications, and then you can have those that are kind of anti-education and anti-qualification, and they can be in the opposite direction. But thankfully, most of the studios that I've been in contact with, I am pleased to say, are aware of just the diversity of people in the industry and the different ways that people have come to games.
Mm-hmm. With different tutorial sites, particularly with sites like Udemy, they provide quality learning materials for anybody interested in game development, obviously. Do you think that is a valid path for people who don't necessarily have either the time or the money for formal education?
Yes, I mean, I think that you can learn a ton from online video content, whether it's Udemy, whether it's Pluralsight, whether it's LinkedIn Learning. You can learn a ton through that. In fact, the problem with online content is not so much too little choice, it's too much choice. And the question inevitably revolves around, where do I begin? Which one do I take first? How do I get started? But there is a rich load of content out there that can teach you how to make video games. Sure. So, you know, they are really, really viable. They are really, really great things to study. There are some benefits that formal education can offer that they do not. But that doesn't change the fact that the materials that you can learn, particularly technical content, you can learn a ton of that stuff from video content. Sure.
Moving on then to your role with the NFTS, how did that come about?
Well, my role at the NFTS, I started teaching for part of the time at the NFTS alongside other freelance work I was doing. So I wasn't initially the head of department. I was teaching there as a tutor in programming and games development, helping students build their games. And then my predecessor, John Weinbrand, decided, well, you know, it was time for him to move on, try new things. And so the role became available. And I thought that running a games course, an MA course, particularly at a really prestigious and a really creative institution like the National Film and Television School, would be a really great thing, because I'd already seen the great work that the students at the NFTS were producing, the really great ideas, and the ethos of the course really excited me too, because our course at the NFTS has a really great ethos that is, you don't necessarily need a background to come onto the course. You don't necessarily need a background in games to come onto the course. You don't need to have that technical background. You can come onto the course from all walks of life and change your career, make a big difference in your life, so that at the end of our two-year MA, you can graduate with a game development skill set, even though you may not have entered with one.
What about how the industry has changed over the last, well, obviously 20 years, but even in the last 3 years since you've started at NFTS?
Yes, I mean, I think that the industry is, well, the games industry changes so quickly that you have to constantly be running just to stand still. But I think that despite the technological changes that we see, whether it's in VR, whether it's in the way that we can capture motion, whether it's in the way we can capture facial expressions, or whether it's creating photoreal environments, and even the developments in game engines and game software that we use, all of those things are always moving at a pace, and it's important for courses to keep up. But fundamentally, one of the things that has remained throughout is that if you've got great ideas and you've got great stories that you want to tell, if you can tell them effectively and be a really great storyteller through your games, it sticks with people. You still have people now talking about games they played in their childhood, games they played over 10 years ago. It's not because those games are still looking great compared to the newer games, but it's because those games did something fundamentally right at a creative storytelling or design level. And by creating games that people can remember, captivate people's imagination, whether you're making that now, whether you made it 10 years ago, whether you're making it in the future, you can be a really powerful influencer. So sure, technically, a lot has changed in the industry, but still the focus on storytelling, great creative principles, they're still skills that are very much established and are core to really great games.
The course itself then, Game Design and Development Masters, can you tell me more about it?
Yeah, I mean, so I think that one of the benefits, or there are several benefits that I think, I mean, we were discussing about, one of the things we mentioned a short time ago was about, can you learn how to make games through online video content, through piecing together your knowledge through courses? And from the other point of view, in terms of a formal education, an MA in Games Design and Development, which is the course that we offer at the film school, one of the central themes that runs through that and the benefits of having that formal education, some of the things it can offer you that a lot of online content normally doesn't, is one, which we've already touched on, which is the idea of maybe you want to make games and you want to be a games developer, you want to be the game developer of the next generation, but there's so much stuff to learn. You can go online, you can learn a load of tools and content, but there's still the fundamental question of, where is the right place to begin? What is the right order to study subjects? Should I perform them in steps 1, 2, or 3? So one thing that's really, really crucial here is that with the guidance of tutors, with the structure of the curriculum, we can help people build a pathway that can connect together their learning. The other thing is that there's a lot of content out there for technical skills. If you want to learn the Unity engine or the Unreal engine, there's a course for those. If you want to learn C++ programming, there's a course for that. There's a lot of courses targeted at technical, practical software skills, and that's really great. But there are lots of other skills that aren't so well covered in the online courses that are available. And I'm thinking more broadly here about skills such as producing, developing business plans that are relevant to the games industry, effective ways to pitch ideas, to promote games, and the business of games, going through contracts, looking at intellectual property, going all through these other kinds of things that are related to games and to games business. And another thing that our course does is it tries to wrap all of that up into one neat package. And in terms of the amount of learning that goes on, well, it's just a two-year MA, but all of the tutors that we have on the course, they're not full-time tutors. They were tutors as I was before I became the head of the course, and that was they were tutors that were fundamentally practicing in the industry, and they would come in for different days at scheduled times, and they brought with them their current industry skills so that people were learning the latest stuff in the best ways possible. So they were packing in effectively decades worth of learning into just a two-year MA.
Do you think that's one of the benefits that your course has over courses held in other universities, the fact that a lot of the guest tutors and what have you are still working in the industry?
That's certainly one of them, yeah. I think some other ones are that our course is incredibly practical, particularly for a course where people who often join it are not from a games background. So we've had people who have been pie makers, chocolatiers, kickboxing instructors, graduates in neuroscience, people who have completely decided to change their career and to come onto the games course. And when they've come onto the games course, in the first year, they make essentially five games. They learn how to make games while making them. And every single one of our modules on the course, the output of it is a real, tangible game that people can play. It's not an essay about a game. It's not a game design document that stands on its own. It's an actual tangible game that you can play. So in the first year, you actually have to make five games, and you're not just involved at the margins of that process. You do the coding, the art, the animation. You put together the worlds themselves using software and using tools. And then in the second year of the course, it's become a catchphrase, but I'm going to say it again. It's 1 year, one student, one game. And effectively, you have the entirety of the second year to design and build a game. And I think we're blessed also at being at a film school. One of the other great blessings that we have is that we have so many creative departments across the school. So games doesn't live in isolation. At the film school, we've got a screenwriting department. We've got a composing department, cinematography department, sound design department. We've got a ton of different departments. And students in the games course can build collaborations with other people in other departments. So you put together effectively your own game development team in that second year. And so you have all of these creative interactions to really create some interesting stuff.
Yeah, I've seen some of that collaboration firsthand. Students working with composers and people who are helping them out with sort of the PR and marketing materials and things like that, which actually then brings me on to a big part of the course being the attendance at EGX and EGX Raised.
Yeah.
How did that sort of collaboration start, or how did the NFTS sort of join up to that and start getting booths and things at EGX?
Yeah, I mean, the games course has been attending EGX since before I became the head of department. It had become historically a kind of annual thing that happens. The first years of the course attend EGX as visitors. And the second years, who have been working on their game, their year-long project, attend as exhibitors. And each one of the second years gets a space on the booth, and they get to showcase their game. And this is something that is planned for way back at the beginning of the year. And unlike many other institutions, our academic year does, making sense, actually tie up to the academic year. So it's January to December. It's not September to some other time, August, for example. It actually runs from January to December. So way back at the beginning of January, our second years are already planning. What game will I be making? What will I be showcasing at EGX? And EGX has traditionally fallen at that really great time, September, October time, much later in the year, after which a lot of work has been done. So EGX has typically been a really, really great opportunity for our second years to go there and attend and exhibit as indie developers. And throughout that year, our game students will be building up collaborations with people across the school, including the marketing students at the NFTS. We have a marketing course, MDSE, Marketing, Sales, Distribution and Exhibition. And each of our game students get paired up with a marketing student. And from January to EGX, they work closely together on building a marketing plan for how are we going to exhibit? Are we going to be creating a poster? What will the poster look like? Will there be merchandise? How will this appear at the stand? So it really is leading up to that exhibition at EGX.
The organizers of EGX then, how much help do they provide to yourselves and the students, or are you just left to your own devices in the same way that the other people exhibiting at the event manage?
Yeah, I mean, EGX are really great. They are incredibly helpful, incredibly supportive. They provide us with a lot of help and a lot of guidance about the requirements for the artwork that we need to provide to get it to look good on the stand. Mm. If we have a question about the space and the arrangement, and one of the questions that commonly comes up is, what kind of space do we have? How large is the space? If we want to exhibit, for example, a VR game and we need to have light stands positioned, where can we position those? If we want to have banners and posters that stand separate from the desk, where are they going to stand? Mm. So we might have lots of questions, practical questions about the space and how that's designed. And they're really, really great with helping us out about that so that we can design and anticipate how our space is going to look before we go to the event. I mean, these are practical, logistical questions that I think every single indie developer who goes to showcase at EGX is going to be asking to make sure that on the day when those people visit the stand, they're going to have a great experience.
Mm. The opportunities then that EGX provides to the students, is that something that is really unique for them?
Yes, I mean, I think that the experience of EGX, attending an industry event, having your game seen by a lot of people is really, I think, incredibly valuable. EGX is not the only event that we historically attend. We also normally attend Develop in Brighton, and we meet a lot of contacts and we meet a lot of people there. Mm. This industry communication, whether it's in person, whether it's online, is incredibly valuable to the student work and the work that we do. It's not the only thing that's valuable, of course. We invite a lot of people from the industry to come and visit the NFTS, and they see the students one-to-one. They talk to them. They play their games. They interact with the students. They talk about trends in the industry, about the things that they're doing at their studios. We also go to visits at game studios to see how game studios operate on a day-to-day basis in a normal setting. What would they be doing? Obviously, COVID has put some changes on some of those things. Mm. But in many cases, regardless of whether people are operating in person or remotely, they're still doing game development work, and we can still connect with people, even remotely via Zoom, remotely via Teams, so that we can still keep that connection between the students and the industry. EGX is an important part of that connection because we can go to that event, showcase the student work. And I've had so many people who have dropped me an email after EGX to say, you know, hey, I came by the NFTS stand and I tried this really, really bizarre game. I tried this really interesting game and, you know, I hadn't played anything quite like that before. Can you put me in touch with the developer of that game? I really want to talk more with them about that.
That actually leads me on quite nicely to the student project. Having been at EGX a good number of years now, the NFTS stand is always sort of one of the highlights or one of the places that I always try and make a point of going to, just because I know that I will see something a little bit different there. Have any of the student projects ever made their way from concept to a commercial release? And if not, is there a reason why not?
Yeah, so a few have. So Anna Ribeiro, she initially created a game for her second year project called Pixel Rift, was how it began. It was her second year project using the Oculus Rift. And after graduating, she continued to pursue that project, which is now released as a commercial game, Pixel Ripped, which is available on Steam and other platforms too. So we had also some other graduates who have gone off to pursue Off Grid. That received funding from the UK Games Fund. It hasn't been released yet, but it's due to be released very soon. And we've also had two other students who have gone on to graduate and create obviously inappropriate content, which was a game at EGX not too far back, actually. Again, that has not yet made commercial release, but it's on its way to doing so. So we have a selection of games that have made their way to commercial release or are very close to being on their way to commercial release. It's something that we encourage people to do. I think most students begin that second year with a mindset of, I'm going to be creating a game and it might not be something that just ends with the course. It's something that I can continue on up beyond graduation and pursue to a commercial release. Mm-hmm. It might be that a student is seeking to pursue it to commercial release as an independent developer, or it might be that they're seeking funding or they're seeking a publisher to help them do that. But I encourage every single student when they're creating their second year game to at least begin with the view that this is not just something that's going to end with the course. For some people, it is, because they decide that they want their graduate game to be a portfolio piece. It's going to be the thing that gets them a job at a studio rather than something they continue commercially. So people do see that project in two different ways. One is that it's a portfolio piece that's leveraged for getting a job, and for others, it's something that's going to be expanded into a commercial game.
Does the NFTS have any financial interest in students' projects that could potentially make it to a commercial release?
Well, I mean, the NFTS, they always want a student's games to do well. I think that's partly because, you know, that's something that they want for the student. They want the student to be successful. We have an IP contract that students can sign with the NFTS to agree to carry on making their game beyond graduation. And so long as they're treating all their collaborators fairly, then there's no necessary financial gain for the film school. The one thing that we like to make sure is that if students have teamed up, for example, with, say, a collaborator who's a composer or a sound designer, that all their work within that in the game that they're continuing on beyond graduation is recognized.
Has any consideration ever been made for using a platform like itch.io to showcase student work in a more publicly and easily accessible way?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm really in favor of doing that. I want the students to try to showcase their work and to showcase what they can do. So absolutely. In fact, we already have some NFTS projects that have been put onto itch.io in which people can play.
The application window for the 2021 enrollment will be closing soon. I think it's sometime in the end of November, start of December. Has there been a difference this year in the number of applications so far, given the situation caused by COVID-19?
I think there's been a difference in the views of people of what a course is for, and I think in their strategy for applying to the course. I don't think there's been a difference per se in the numbers, but certainly in the diversity of people that are applying to the course. I think that COVID has presented people with that opportunity to stop and reflect. And for some people, that decision has been forced upon them. It might be that, for example, a contract has ended for them, or they're in a field of work that has been really badly affected by COVID. And so a decision has come into their lives where maybe their careers, they don't see them the same kind of future in those careers anymore. And so they're stopping to pause and think, well, you know, maybe I should be doing something else. And so I think that many people who are pausing to say, oh, I could make a change in my career, are looking at the courses out there, are feeling excited about games development. So certainly a lot of people who are applying are people who are deciding, hey, you know what, I can really just change my career. We had a lot of people apply to the course even before COVID who were people in completely different careers who wanted to make that change. And I think what we're seeing now is just a greater number of people whose careers have been affected who feel, games could be a possible future for me.
How has COVID had an effect on the continuing education of students this year?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's something I was really worried about because, I mean, COVID, you know, it kind of invaded our lives pretty quickly. And there was a very, very short period of time where 1 week learning was continuing as normal. And then the next week, everything had changed. There was a lockdown. So I think as a course, in terms of resources and learning, I think the film school generally, not just the games course, but the film school as an institution, I think responded very well and very swiftly. within just a few days, the lab equipment that our game students use on a daily basis, and by the lab equipment, I mean the computers and the development resources that our students would be accustomed to using on a day-to-day basis on site at the film school, we had that equipment delivered to the students' home addresses so that they could continue working on their games remotely during the lockdown period. And then we used a variety of tools like Zoom, for example, to keep in contact with students and to keep a classroom atmosphere so that people could still make their games from home. Now, we operated for a period of between March to September in lockdown, and we came back face to face again back at the film school in person in September. And during the entirety of that period, our first year students, for example, put together three games. One was Hallowell, the very first module. The second one was Code Camp, where they learn the fundamentals of computer programming. And then the third one is App Factory, where they build mobile games. So three games they created during that period. So that's a really great achievement. And in fact, not only is that a great achievement for people who might be approaching game development for the very first time, but it's also a great achievement because the entire curriculum was on track. We ended the lockdown period with the entirety of the curriculum on track.
Do you think the remote teaching and remote communication and things is actually beneficial to those students this year purely because of the amount of remote working opportunities within the industry?
Yes. I mean, I think that there are advantages and disadvantages to it, certainly. One of the disadvantages is that there is something about online communication that can't quite be captured face to face, just the serendipity of meeting people in and around the film school and having this spontaneous chat about creative ideas. But nonetheless, I think there's a lot that we can learn from the remote teaching and from the online learning and from working remotely. Not only is there the opportunity that you can, you know, you can operate with online tools, you can become more computer literate, you can adapt to learning in new and different ways, but also when people graduate, having that benefit of using these remote tools is something that they're going to be taking with them to use in other areas of the industry. As you rightly say, there are quite a few game studios that are operating remotely. And if many students want to graduate and go into working in freelance, then, well, they can operate remotely using that too.
You've been in the industry nearly 20 years now. What things still surprise you about an industry that generates greater revenues than both the film industry and the music industry?
I guess one of the things that surprises, sometimes shocks me, sometimes horrifies me, and sometimes delights me, is the fact that the industry is in many ways a wild west. There isn't a formal, rigid structure and hierarchy. You can go to one game studio, they operate in one way, the job roles are called something there, the tools they use are a particular set of tools. You can jump to a different studio, and then the rules are suddenly very different. You can be sitting in an office and the people sitting next to you could be the creative director, could be the producer. You could go to a different studio and it's much more segregated. I think that one of the really interesting things about the games industry is just how unpredictable it is. And there are some amazing things that can happen that still do not cease to amaze me to this day. For example, it could be that you are sitting at home and you decide one day to teach yourself games development from the comfort of your bedroom or your home office or wherever you are. You learn game development tools. You create a really interesting idea. You put your game onto the app store and straight away your game, your app is listed side by side with multi-million dollar corporations. You could be getting just as much attention as they are. Your product, if it gets noticed, if it generates that excitement, it could be just as successful as games that were manufactured by hundreds of people. So potentially you have this really interesting power where you can put together so many things independently, list it online, and achieve really great things overnight.
What do you think the industry needs to do to mature further?
What does it need to do to mature further? Well, I suppose one of the things that I would really like to see is a better recognition of work-life balance. This isn't necessarily a problem at all studios, because there are tons out there that do respect that. But I think that in an industry where people are creative and passionate about what they do, there's a tendency on the part of the creatives to put their heart and soul into things. But there's also a culture in some places where they're not really respecting that work-life balance. So one of the things that I would really love to see in the industry is a bit less of crunch time, mm-hmm. and a greater understanding for the fact that game developers are human beings with so many different interests. Sure, they may be passionate about the games they make. They may really love the games they work on. But there are also other aspects to their lives. Could be family life, hobbies, creative pursuits, things that might be outside of games, and that it's important to have that balance. Mm-hmm. I think there are some areas of the industry that really aren't recognizing that, and I would really, really love to see that, because I think it's so important. It's so important, not just for an individual's health and well-being, but it's also on a practical level really important for cultivating innovation and creativity.
The industry itself has a little bit of an issue with diversity and equality. Particularly, it's been made an awful lot more obvious over the past couple of years. What can it do to work on that?
Well, I think one thing that it certainly can and is beginning to do, and I'm pleased to see, is to recognize and to celebrate the contributions of the many people that work in the games industry. Mm. I think one thing, a great start and a great beginning, is to spotlight and highlight some of the great things that individuals are doing. That's the first step to, I think, recognize it. And then the second step, I think, is to take a long, hard look about the diversity of people at a game studio and to recognize that we can make these studios a better place by increasing that diversity and that representation. Mm-hmm. By looking at the diversity of our staff, by looking at the diversity of the board of directors, by looking at the diversity of the people working on these games, we can make those games better. So I think the first step needs to be recognition of that talent and a celebration of that. And then the second step is to take a long, hard look about the day-to-day habits and the day-to-day norms that have been established, and to question their origins and to question whether we, on a day-to-day basis, could ourselves be doing something better to further that. I think it needs to begin with that personal, psychological step to want to make the change, first of all.
Mm-hmm. At the start of the question, I was asking just about, or while saying about how the industry compares to both the film industry and the music industry. Is there anything the industry can do to help gain a more mainstream acceptance, particularly by traditional media coverage outlets, TV and print media?
Yeah, I think so. And I think also this is an area where I think some significant progress is being made. I think what we're seeing, the crossover with games and film, an area that's increasingly being referred to, I think, as immersive. Mm-hmm. We've got that immersive space where there's an interesting crossover beginning to happen. I think some of the things that we can do to really push that as games developers is develop a greater awareness, at least from the point of view of game developer to filmmaker, we can develop a greater awareness among people about the value that our software, our tools, and our creative processes have for filmmakers. Mm. But I think also as games developers, there are opportunities that we should be using, getting in touch with filmmakers, keeping in contact with filmmakers and television people, just to get an idea of what they're doing and to learn from them too. Not to think that games is always leading the way, but also to listen to other people and to see how we can make those merges happen. We're already beginning to see that with some games that we see. We see, for example, games like The Bunker, mm-hmm. that tries to merge full motion video and storytelling with games. So we're beginning to see that. I think to gain also mainstream acceptance, wider acceptance, I think some of the games that we need to be creating and pushing should not just be centered around violence, not just centered around this idea of, oh, here's another game where you get to shoot stuff, mm-hmm. but also pushing bigger projects that tell bigger stories, that use real actors, that are prepared to look at pushing storytelling in completely different ways. One of the things that we try to encourage here on the games course at the NFTS is exactly that, is to utilize a lot of the resources we have at the film and television school that goes just beyond games and into all kinds of other areas to try to encourage people to create games that don't necessarily repeat the traditional patterns of here's a game where you shoot stuff, here's a game where you match stuff, but to actually create games that do things that are different. Mm. Sometimes those experiments, they work out really successfully, and I'm delighted when they do. Sometimes the experiments don't work out so well, and by not work out so well, I mean they're not necessarily so fun to play. But that doesn't mean to say that there wasn't a lot that we could learn from that. So I think from the creative side, from the side of games developers to filmmakers, I think it's important for both sides to be in touch with each other. But I think from the point of view of game developer to audience, one of the ways we can broaden games to enter more areas of the mainstream is to show that games are not just about violence. It's not just about shooting stuff. It's not just about leaderboards.
Where do you stand on the question about can games be art?
Okay, so can games be art? I think games can be art. I think that. But I would say this. I can't venture to you a definition of art that would satisfy probably anybody. And I'm not sure I could muster together a definition. All I can say is this, that I really love art. I feel like I know art when I see it. And I've played some games and I feel a sense of art from them. I guess that means I think games can be art. But I kind of have that view where make games, love the act of making it. Maybe people will enjoy it and they'll enjoy it as art. And if they do, that's great. And while they're enjoying it, just make more games.
Mm. Yeah. Are there any new ideas or games that have wowed you recently?
Yes. So one of the games that really struck me, well, two games, I guess one might not be called a game, but we'll see. So one game that always interests me is Procession to Cavalry. It's an indie game, and the developer also created a game a few years ago that was based on the same idea, where the entire art style was assembled from Renaissance paintings. Mm-hmm. So the idea is that you would take different elements from the game and you would assemble effectively a comedy, but your entire game assets could only be taken from Renaissance paintings. And I think that gives those games a really, really striking look, a really, really striking visual feel that are not commonly found elsewhere. So I really, really love those games. Another game that really wowed me was Microsoft Flight Simulator, which for me, some people might say, well, that's not really a game, that's more a simulator. But it's still using the same tech and tools as game, just by its sheer vastness, its sheer attention to detail, the sheer amount of data that comes with it, just the attempt to try to encompass just so much in one package. That certainly really wowed me. Untitled Goose Game was another one that really kind of, I thought, well, that was really, really great. So there are a few titles out there that I really love, but I think that really for me, the things that are dearest to my heart is when a game just tells a charming story without pretense and without a preoccupation with a kind of preoccupation with always needing to be the latest in tech or showcase this or that feature of tech. It's not tech-led, but it's story-led or design-led, and it just wants to tell you a great story.
That actually brings me on nicely to my next question, which is, with a new console generation starting literally within the next couple of days, and arguably a new PC one with the launch of new high-end graphics cards, is the industry too reliant on the progress of technology to sell its products?
I don't know if the word I would use is reliant, but I would certainly say that there's a great excitement. I mean, the games industry has never been especially nostalgic about the past. It's always wanted to be very forward-looking and wanted to embrace new technology and tools. And, you know, it says something for the fact that if you want to play, for example, the original Mario game, you can't really do it. You can play remakes, you can play modernized versions of it, but if you wanted to play the original, it's difficult to do that unless you really hunt down the original hardware and the original game itself, and you play it, and you kind of have to brush off the dust, and there are many things that are not backwards compatible. So I don't think the games industry has been particularly kind to its past, and that's partly a reflection of the fact that it's obsessed with its future. But I think, and so I think there's a connection there with this kind of obsession and preoccupation about technology, about what technology can achieve. And it's easy to be impressed. You can look at tech demos that approximate photorealism. You've only got to take a look at some of the new demos of the Unreal Engine 5 or to look at tech demos produced by Unity to see some of the amazing content and levels of realism that can be achieved. And it's easy, very easy to be impressed by this. But of course, while that's all great, I think it doesn't detract from the fact that, as we said way back in this chat, that games can stick with you when they have memorable characters, when they tell great stories, when they do really interesting things that stick with you and hold on to you. For example, I still remember now the original release of Half-Life, the very first Half-Life game. And I remember in the very first few minutes of that game, where it's branded as a kind of first-person shooter, right? But there wasn't any shooting. You wandered around for 10 minutes talking to people. There was a build-up, there was an anticipation, and then suddenly the story unfolded from this catastrophic event. And I remember that now. And I remember that not because of the graphics, not because of the animation, not because of the tools they used, but just simply because it was so well executed in terms of storytelling and aesthetic. So, sure, it's easy for things to be too obsessed about technology. The technology is really important. It is really important because without it, we would not be able to create fantastic looking games and really great experiences. So the technology is really, really important. But there's a difference between recognizing its importance and being led solely by the tech, which I don't think we can do if we want to make really interesting games. If we want to make really interesting games, we have to use the tech that there is and aspire to the tech of the future, but not lose sight of the fact that, hey, you know, we need to be creating really interesting games, great stories, great characters. There's no substitute for that.
At this stage in the interview, I would normally ask three quick questions, but because I still have some contacts with some former NFTS students, I approached them for some questions for you.
Okay.
So first one is there a wholesale supplier you're getting your shirts from, or are they all homespun?
Well, the shirt I'm wearing today is pretty ordinary, but yes, I've got some pretty wild shirts that I love enormously. They're not homespun. You know, I really wish I could make my own clothes. I really wish I could. Well, I can, but I do a bad job. So it's not something I would wear. So no, I mean, I used to have a friend who had their own business, their own clothing store. And very generous they were. They had great stuff. So I got a lot of my clothing from them. Unfortunately, their business no longer operates. So, you know, I am without my supplier of amazing shirts.
What are some of your proudest student moments?
Oh. Well, I guess, you know, most people, I suppose, would expect ahead of a course to say when a student gets a job. Mm-hmm. And of course, that does make me proud, and I'm happy to see that. But one of the things we were talking about are some of the positive changes that can come about in the games industry. And one of the things I mentioned was I think that positive change in the industry is brought about not just by people getting a job and making games. Sure, that's great that you can do that. But it's also brought about by people who find a life mission in games, who don't just want to make games as a job, but something has clicked in them that pursuing games is not just a route to making money, it's also a route to making positive change in the world. I think the proudest moments for me as an educator have been those moments when I feel that somebody who may be not from games has come onto the course, and there's a point in their learning or in their development where they feel like they've found their niche. They've found their why. Why am I here? Why am I in games? Sometimes it doesn't always arrive immediately. People might have this intuitive sense of, I want to make games. But then if you say, what kind of games do you want to make? Who are you making your games for? For some people, this is still an open question. Mm-hmm. But that moment arrives when you think, these are the kinds of games that I would really love to make, and these are the people I'm making them for. And by making these games, I'm not just making a game, but I'm making a positive difference to the world. This is a mission. When that moment clicks and somebody feels that that's their reason for being a games developer, that's when I feel really proud. It's a hard moment to detect, and I can't quantify it. Oh, it's when this curve on the graph changes this way. I can't quantify it in that sense at all. But there are those moments where something clicks and you can see it click within them. Then I feel very proud about that.
What drives you to start a new game, project, or challenge? And conversely, what would prompt you to leave or move on from one?
I suppose the things that would prompt me to start a new games project or challenge, one of the requirements would be, I think, for me, is this game, by making this game, are we going to achieve two things? One is, are we going to grow as developers and people and always be learning? And hopefully, in most cases, the answer to that would be yes. In the second instance, I think the other question would have to be, when we're producing this game, are we really going to have a big impact with this game? Or is it just going to be a game that's just going to sit alongside all the others and be another point and click and be another action game? Because sure, it's great. You can go ahead and you can do that. But what would motivate me was a game that would be a statement piece, whether it was promoting a cause. For example, one thing I remember being really inspired by, we had one student on our course who was making a game to raise awareness about bees and wildlife and the importance of bees. And there was another game, Disconnected, about autism. So there have been lots of games, another game called Misfolded about mental health. So there are many, many games out there that are statement pieces that are doing really, really interesting, bold things that excite me. And I think a game like that would certainly excite me. In terms of a game that I would say, well, I have to leave. This is not something I want to work on anymore. I think one would be fundamentally a game that is either perpetuating the traditional ways and traditional stereotypes. Certainly wouldn't be interested in that. And I think fundamentally a game that isn't a game. A game that it can sometimes happen during development where you're working on a game and then you just sit back and you say, this really isn't fun anymore. And it's not fun because we haven't tweaked the parameters right. It's just that there's something fundamentally wrong with the concept, that this just isn't interesting anymore.
Do you have any good horror or success stories from the industry?
Horror or success stories? I think in terms of success stories, I'm always in two minds about the success of this, but it's certainly something that really touched me. Was in 2011, I released my indie game called Baron Wittard. And I always have mixed feelings about Baron Wittard. There are days when I really like it and there are days when I don't. But I remember releasing that game, and it was a very, very difficult puzzle game. Really, really difficult. And I remember being impressed because on the day after release, I remember somebody got in touch with me and they emailed me and they said they had completed the game. And I personally couldn't believe that somebody could complete that game that quickly. So they then sent me evidence to prove they had completed the game. And not only was I incredibly pleased about this and impressed, they introduced me to their group of friends, all of whom had been playing the game together. And it turned out that they'd established a complete community of puzzle solvers. And this entire community of puzzle solvers were all retired ladies, all retired ladies in Russia, who had formed this group together to solve puzzle games. And this group apparently went up buying all different sorts of puzzle games to solve these puzzle games. And there was a challenge among them as to who could do it the first. And I was absolutely delighted. I mean, it's more a personal success story, but I was absolutely delighted that on the day of release of Baron Wittard, that this community of puzzle solvers had set their sights on Baron Wittard, this game that initially was quite obscure, and they defeated it pretty quickly, and I was delighted that they had done so. For me, the success there was that the sense of success that I had reached this community of diehard puzzle solvers so much that they'd wanted to kind of tackle this game and to solve it. For me, that was a really great success. Kind of strange story, but I actually really was absolutely fascinated because I still don't understand to this day how anyone can complete Baron Wittard in the space of a day. Amazing. Well done, those people, by the way.
My last question then is, I've been asked to ask you about ghost hunting.
What about it?
I'm not entirely sure. I was just told, ask him about ghost hunting.
Well, I think, so one of the things that really interests me on a personal level is the supernatural. Mm. And in fact, the game Baron Wittard, released in 2011, it is a game about the supernatural. I'm just fascinated by the haunted UK. Just various sites around the British Isles, around the UK, and around the world more broadly, of places that are haunted. Really interested in ghost stories about, is this place haunted? I think that it just makes incredible material for video games. I think one of the things that this kind of links back to, and it's one of the things that I encourage of all my students on the NFTS Games course, is that it's great to want to be a games developer. It's great to want to make games, but it's also important to cultivate interests outside of games. Mm. Because when you have those interests outside of games, you can tap into them for inspiration. They're conversation pieces. They're pieces where you can learn stuff about the world. So whether it's ghosts or whether it's a supernatural, they're all sources of things that you can look to include in your games. So every student who comes onto the games course, I'm always really, really clear about the fact that, sure, it's great to make games. It's great to read up on games. It's great to learn about them. But if you're 100% games, always be reflecting on that, because there can be another part of you, another interest, whether it's skydiving, whether it's, you know, car racing, whether it's boxing, whether it's chess, whether it's boxing and chess together, whatever it is that interests you, to have those outside interests. For me, one of them is just ghosts and the supernatural. Absolutely fascinating stuff. What do you think about ghosts? Do you believe in ghosts?
I'm honestly not sure. So no. I'm not. There's enough people out there who have said they have seen something or experienced something, and it's kind of hard to dismiss that outright. But scientifically, there doesn't seem to be enough evidence to say yes or no. Yeah. So yeah, I'm still on the fence, but certainly, you know, I can see why people are so interested in it.
Yeah, absolutely. Me too.
Thank you very much, Alan. That has been a really, really good interview, so it has. At this stage, I'd like to just pass it over to yourself to either promote, obviously, NFTS and the course and what have you.
Sure.
But allow you time to draw people's attention to anything else that you think people should go and check out.
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, I'd like to say, first of all, that it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you this evening, Stuart. But it's also, you know, it's my pleasure to be able to talk with you about games and also to talk with you about the NFTS Games course. You know, I started running that course in 2017, and I tried to design and build it to be exactly the kind of course that I wish I had around back when I decided to go into games, when there weren't any courses around. Back when I wanted to say, well, look, you know, I'm excited about making games. I'm excited about going into the games industry. I want to create great games. And I'm not really sure about how to do that. I wish I had something to help me out. And so I build the course on that premise, that this is a course for people wanting to go into games. You don't necessarily need a background in games. You don't necessarily need to be a games expert or have made games before. This is a course for people from all walks of life who can come to into the games industry and make a positive difference. You can check out more information about our course by visiting nfts.co.uk and just type in game design. You can get to the link. We're still accepting people for that course for the intake of 2021. So if this sounds like something, if the games industry sounds like a place where you want to be, then do check out the course, because it's a great two-year course where you'll learn a ton of stuff. And ideally, as I said, you not only will learn a ton of stuff, but you will find your mission in games. And it's been an absolute pleasure since 2017 working with just so many talented people. And I know that you've been speaking to the students on the course. You have really, you know, been incredibly supportive of our course. You've come by our stand. You've seen the students work for yourself. You've met with students. You've spoken with students. You've even taken questions for this interview from students. So you know many of our graduates and what great people they are. And I consider myself to be in a very privileged position to have to be working at the NFTS and to have worked with so many amazingly talented people. Those people may not have started with games, but they're in games now. And what they've brought into the games industry is just phenomenal. They're really, really wonderful people. And I'm incredibly proud of all the people who have graduated from our games course. It's been a real pleasure working with them.
Excellent. As I say, Alan, it has been an absolute pleasure talking to you, so it has. Thank you for listening to the show. If you want to get in contact with us, you can follow the Twitter feed at @howtomakeagame. That's the number two. You can follow my own personal feed, which is Saintly Stewart on Twitter. And you can find the podcast itself on anchor.fm and most other podcasting outlets, also including Spotify now as well. Thank you, Alan. It has been an absolute pleasure. It has been, yeah, a great interview. As I say, NFTS was always one of the highlights for me at any of my EGX visits. And yeah, the fact that I've been able to then speak to some of the students whenever they've been exhibiting on other games that they have then moved on to within the industry, it says an awful lot about how well they were prepared for the industry itself and, you know, what they gained out of it. As well, and it's I think what the course does for the students themselves, and you know, obviously prepares them and everything for the industry, is just amazing.
Great, thank you very much, Stuart. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.